Greetings, dear listeners. Back to form this week, just me and Shoddy. This episode is why Wisdom of Crowds is important to me, personally. Going back and forth with my friend Shoddy just gets me thinking about issues in new and interesting ways. On the table for discussion, campus protests over the Gaza War. Definitely stick around for part two for subscribers only, where we get into some spicy and tricky territory on Shoddy's pro-woke turn, as well as some deeper philosophical questions about why we end up rallying to one cause over another. Even as we talk about universal ideals, is it ethnic and religious affinity that matters most? Before we get started, a reminder to head on over to wisdomofcrowds.live and consider becoming a paying subscriber if you're not one yet. And don't forget to give us a like and review on your favorite podcast app. With all that out of the way, on to the show. I mean, it's interesting. We're joking about black is beautiful. You said brown is beautiful. And you said Arabs don't do that so much because in Arab societies, there's also skin colorism as a thing. I think I'm not putting words in your mouth, right? So like that's why South Asians, Indians, Pakistanis will go for the brown is beautiful, but Arabs less so. And American Arabs we're talking about here.
Oh, no, this is definitely the case for Arab countries as well.
But I mean, like, brown is beautiful is an Americanism. I don't
think that's a global concept. It is a very American thought, like, to sort of, you know, take something about your identity and really assert it and to sort of celebrate it as part of a self-care regimen.
Yeah.
I think that is a uniquely American thing, but also probably part of what makes America great is that you have people who are celebrating different parts of their identity. And I guess that's good, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a good jumping off point. You sent me a text by Matt Iglesias to begin with. You know, I think we can't avoid talking about all the campus stuff here. I just want to preface this that for our longer term listeners who may remember maybe like 6 months ago, 9 months ago, 10 months ago, Shoddy was in this blissful mode of just like, I don't follow the news. And then we'd have entire episodes where he'd be like, hey man, what's going on in the world? And then he'd like quiz me about stuff. I just got back from vacation and I am in full Shoddy 10 months ago mode. Like, wow. I unplugged so fully, so wonderfully. And I really feel great. I mean, even more recent listeners will remember a couple of months ago, I was just completely like wrecked. And we talked about it. Was how tired I was. I feel so much better now. So what I'm saying is like, I mean, I came back, from this vacation and just as all this like campus stuff was blown up. And I mean, you know, I really wasn't really reading the news while I was gone. And I mean, sort of was paying attention a little bit as I was coming in. A day or two back, I even tweeted something like, I don't understand. Like, I don't understand why this is such a big story. I mean, obviously, it's a big story. Obviously, a lot of people were riled up about it. So that's the spirit in which I'm looking forward to this conversation. The classic old Wisdom of Crowds, where one of us is completely blissed out and not paying attention. The other one is more involved, and we can have some sort of like cross-examination, hopefully, in that regard.
Well, the thing is, like, I totally forget those good old days. And like, where I was sort of, I didn't follow. I guess I wasn't following foreign policy all that much for a while.
Yeah.
That was blissful. It feels so far away now in light of everything that's happened. And to even get, wow, we were so lucky back then. I was so lucky back then. The world was better. I think it's fair to say.
I mean, I'd say it's been on a boil for a while. I mean, I guess we've added one more nastiness, on top of it. So I guess it's in that sense, it's worse, but like, it feels like in aggregate, if we're measuring in sort of, likelihood that it'll get a lot worse, it feels about as bad now as it did before then. Like this, it's weird. It feels to me, even though this has added more misery to the world, I don't feel like we're a step closer or a step further. It feels about the same in level, like terms of dangerousness to me as it did a while ago, for what it's worth. But anyway, yeah. so just to, you know, that's all to say that I don't have like really strong views on all the campus stuff.
Why do you think the campus stuff, why'd you find it kind of boring or annoying, or you couldn't really figure out why it was important? I mean, I actually don't know what your opinion is on this. So
well,
before
I mean,
we really dive into the meat of it, because I obviously do have strong opinions about it.
I mean, I guess that's, I'm going to fob off on that one because I'm really honest about it. I don't have a very strong opinion on it. I mean, I think I have some sort of, base starting off points, which I think are familiar to you and to others, which I'm not an activist. I don't have like a strong feeling that activism changes the world. I think students are prone to this sort of stuff. And I, in general, don't understand fully, the meltdown, around this, you know, quite frankly, I mean, I understand the meltdown among students who are being threatened with like being their having their protests like put down. So I don't understand like the freak out about like why it's important to put down protests. I mean, I guess that's my starting premise. It's like this is the dumb shit young people do. You know, insofar as they break laws, they should be held account, but you know, also with like full appreciation of the fact that it's students, it's young people protesting, yeah. And like they'll break laws, and you know, again, part of the importance of protest is that like if you're breaking a law, you're willing to bear the consequences of that. That's the power of a protest also. So it's like there's also this element of safetyism to the whole thing, which we can discuss, which I also find kind of bizarre, which also is a very modern American thing.
Yeah,
but that's I guess where I'm coming from. And I've not like actually been reading, I haven't found like any really great pieces. They've all felt kind of, how do I put it? Yeah. Just like weird reactions from the gut, like more heat than light on almost anything I've read so far, you know?
So, yeah. So a couple things. Yeah. Just to give some background as to where I'm at. So I do think there is a tenseness to the Israeli-Palestinian debate is already quite charged and tense. I think we've reached a new level of intensity. And because you take something as charged as Gaza and the role of Israel, and then you multiply that by elite campus politics, which are an ongoing obsession for Americans like us who are in the media, we were obsessed with campus politics, especially elite campus politics. Harvard, Yale are perpetually in the news because a lot of the people who write and speak and are commentators, you know, come from some of these schools. So you sort of, it creates this kind of magnifying glass, and I think that's sort of where we're at. Like different currents in our politics are magnifying each other, and we find ourselves in a very difficult personalized debate. And
no, but like I really want to investigate where you're at. It's much more interesting than where I'm at. But I just want to like point out that like even during the woke wars, which presumably are still going on and still inflecting all of this in its own interesting ways. And I think it is interesting to talk to you about that, like how your thinking's changed on all of that. But even then, I mean, you'll remember, I think we had Jen on the podcast, and if not, Jen Mortazashvili on the podcast, and if not on the podcast, certainly offline, we were talking to her. And I've always been like, to the extent like, yeah, like the kids on campus are crazy. I get it, you know? Yeah, all this woke stuff, I know it's roiling campuses. And I do feel like, you know, in the course of the months after, I was like, yeah, okay, it is spilling out beyond. It is like infecting the broader culture. But I've always at core had a kind of, I don't know, like acceptance of that, like of like culture war stuff just being froth on some level. Do you know what I mean? And so again, when people overfocus on campuses, it's a cue to me to like take the sort of the dial in my head that tries to make sense of things and just compensate. I'm like, yes, it's campuses. Therefore, it's crazy. So to make sense of it, I just need to turn the volume down a little bit to like see what's really going on, because it's not that serious because it's fucking students. You know what I mean? Like, and so that's
but it is serious. Yeah. So the serious part is that we're seeing authoritarian tactics by state troopers and police who are, you know, using violence to, obviously, as happens when you try to arrest people who don't want to be arrested, you're going to have confrontations and clashes. And some of the images that we've seen, I think, are really disturbing, especially in Texas, in the University of Texas, Austin, UT Austin, and also in Emory, where state troopers came in. And we're seeing kind of militarization or securitization of campuses where, you know, where it just, it seems repressive, it looks repressive. And then you ask yourself, what are these students really doing to deserve this?
Well,
and
so tell me.
A lot of them aren't breaking laws. They're not necessarily following the rules and regulations of their campuses. And they're being arrested for things like disorderly conduct.
Have you looked into that? Like, I mean, on this is just a question. I haven't, so it's not a leading question. Is there any, like, one can say that clearly there's an overreaction by campus authorities, but it's not extra legal, right? In the sense that
it's not extra legal.
In the sense that if it's private property and the
The
entity wants to press charges if they're not abiding by X,
Princeton,
Y, and Z.
If Princeton and Harvard want people off the lawn and they don't want tents to be there, they can call the police and ask for the encampment to be cleared. Again, we are talking, at least the ones that are most controversial, in private universities where they have considerable jurisdiction in that regard. So yeah, it's not a question of extra legal or not. It is a question of, I think, double standards. I think to myself, if these protests weren't about Palestine and they were about something that enjoyed broad support among Democrats, among the center left, among centrists. So let's say something that was anti-Trump or pro-choice or something about gay rights or something.
You know, I mean, just as you're talking, one that came up to mind right now, do you remember how long we had those goddamn encampments about the 99%, like that whole movement that was in Zuccotti Park and in New York, and then in DC, we had them like for months on Franklin Square and things like that. Finally, the cops did come in to clear those, but those lasted for a very long time. And that's public space where you know, parks and stuff where there's, you know, arguably even more sort of cause of like public spaces being, you know, used and defiled and, you know, filth and all sorts of like code regulations being broken by having people basically camping permanently there. So that's another one.
No, that's interesting. Fair. I hadn't thought about that. I wasn't actually here in DC when that was happening. But I do think there is just something odd that all of a sudden you see a lot of people who are enthusiastic about a crackdown because they don't like the Palestinian cause. They don't empathize with it. They find it to be inherently anti-Semitic. They see it as a cause that is unworthy of support. And you do wonder, if they did think the cause was worthy of support, to what extent their positions would actually change. It goes back to something that I've complained about for a long time. People are just profoundly inconsistent when it comes to their public commitments.
Yeah.
When it comes to free speech, people are more enthusiastic about free speech that they agree with than free speech they disagree with. And they're not, and there's not even like a pretense of neutrality.
Right.
It's not an accident that most of the pro-Israel people that I follow on Twitter want to crack down on the encampments. I wonder why. Is this a coincidence?
But you know, it's I just want to just also remind, I mean, I don't know, you probably don't need reminding, but like our listeners, that the, you know, on the point of consistency, and again on this like campus nonsense and all the stuff, I just remember the rights outrage at all the woke stuff as being itself censorious and limiting on speech, then they turn around and start banning books themselves in libraries. And it's and again, it was the same kind of like dumb double standard and like a total unnecessary own goal. I mean, on this stuff, I guess like I'm kind of a simpleton. It is just like the easiest way to take a stand on something like this, and especially because I don't know, I'm not like particularly emotionally agitated one way or the other by it. Is just like, well, it's just like fall back on the free speech principle, you know, like that seems to me like.
But then there are things that, okay, but there's free speech and then there's free expression that involves tense. And sure. So I think that becomes a little bit more complicated. Should people be allowed? And that's where I think we should be able to make clear statements about free speech, but I don't think that's really what universities are talking about here. They're justifying what they're doing by saying that these tents are disruptive to campus, disorderly. They're citing sanitation and logistical issues. They're saying that it technically breaks rules and regulations, code of conduct, and so forth. Again, I think these things are being selectively enforced because administrations are coming under a lot of pressure from donors to clamp down on pro-Palestine speech. And there is also, I think, something very unfortunate that there are extreme examples of anti-Semitic incidents and slogans that have been used, which are obviously reprehensible. And some of them have come outside of these campuses by non-students who have been mixing in. And there's some confusion around that. But then we have a situation where I think people are taking a minority of the pro-Palestine protests and generalizing to the whole and saying that pro-Palestine protests writ large are inherently anti-Semitic. And you see the same old bugaboos or that, you know, oh, when people say the word intifada, they're being anti-Semitic, or from the river to the sea is inherently anti-Semitic. So we're kind of redoing the debates of several months ago, and it goes on and on. And you have to be in a position to say, listen, guys, if you think that people using the word intifada is inherently anti-Semitic, then obviously we have a definitional issue here. If you think from the river to the sea is inherently anti-Semitic, then you're basically saying that most pro-Palestinian speech can be interpreted one way or the other as anti-Semitic. If you kind of take this to its logical conclusion and you're saying, oh, if people criticize Zionism, then, oh, that's inherent, you know, where does this end? And I think that there is a lot of conflating that's going on here. And I think it's unfortunate that there's been a broader effort to delegitimize and taint these pro-Palestine encampments because of what a small minority of people are doing. And I have not seen any evidence that this minority is representative of the broader movement. And when we look at the George Floyd protests or other protest movements, you're always going to have extreme elements and then you condemn them, but you have to be careful not to say that the entire movement is one way or the other. And I think that's what's happening here, is that you're seeing this kind of broader effort to say that there's something wrong with the entire movement or the entire protest, or, you know, anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, to me, the simplest way out of this is to say that like anti-Semitic speech is free speech too. I know this is awkward because I'm not a Jew. I think this podcast would be much better if I was some sort of like weird Slavic Jew and you were an American Muslim and like my like nihilism mixing with Judaism somehow. Like,
that's
just not going to happen. So like, I don't know. Like, again, listeners should take that as a caveat that, you know, I feel like I can say things that probably, if I was sitting in a different skin, maybe I'd feel very differently on it. But like, ultimately, for me, when you and your enemies start litigating the question of like, what do people mean by intifada, and what do people mean by from the river to the sea? Like, I don't like to see it. I don't like to see you even having to like parse this in public, because I don't know, it seems like, it kind of seems like bullshit to me. Like, not that you're bullshitting, but it's just like, I don't care. I don't care. it's, you know, if you believe certain things, and, you know, I think that's the part, again, what it's my antipathy to activism and like the whole activist culture. So like healthy activism, you need to like keep the core pure, clean, and virtuous. You need to like police the edges of discourse and be like, well, that person actually is truly anti-Semitic and we're not, we're pro-Palestinian. How does that work out? I guess, look, that's a lot of things that I'm saying there. There's an article by Josh Moravchik in the Wall Street Journal, which I thought was interesting. And it made the case that it's just like, he said, I'm much less worried about anti-Semitism than I am about anti-Zionism, in the sense that like the actual like dismantling of the state of Israel as a Jewish national state is the actual big bad thing that could happen that worries me a lot more than people being mean to Jews, he says, as a Jew. I thought that was an interesting, and you know, again, I like, you can parse that argument and think about it any way you want, and speech is speech and the rest of that, but like intent, and if like what's like getting people like really riled up, it's this stuff that's, I don't know, like it is messy in there. Like, and I don't think there are like really clear lines that you can say, you know, most people when they say intifada, they mean this, and river to the sea clearly doesn't mean genocide of the Israelis or whatever. I don't know if that's true. And like, it's like on one level there's speech, and on the other level, there's this like really messy politics that we're dealing with here. Like really messy.
Yeah, but the problem is if you-
One more thing before you go. It's messy politics. And it gets at politics that you and I have like talked about so much here, is that there's like, it's on some level, there's a zero sum element to this. There isn't a way that, you know, all the two state stuff, all of the way that like we've done policy around this ends up being like hope in a kumbaya moment. But ultimately it feels increasingly like the kumbaya moment is out of reach. And so here we are, you know, like that's maybe why people are so like, why tempers are flaring so much, because there isn't a call it a policy solution that can come out of this, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the point that you cited from, I guess, Joshua Moravchik, that's interesting, because at least he's being straight up about what's going on here. And in some ways that's refreshing. In other ways, it's perhaps more worrying that there is an effort to criminalize, punish, and otherwise censor anti-Israel speech, and saying that effectively it doesn't matter if it's actually anti-Semitic. Anything that's anti-Israel or anti the project of Israel as a Jewish state should be out of bounds.
To be fair, he doesn't say it should be out of bounds. He doesn't go that far, if I remember correctly reading it. And I would also say, you know, from my standpoint, like it's speech. Even that is speech. Anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism, it's all speech. So it should be protected. And, you know, say what you want. He's troubled by it. I think what he's getting at is, and why I think the piece is so interesting, he says, all of the talk around the protests is about anti-Semitism. He's like, me personally, I'm not worried nearly about anti-Semitism so much as an American Jew, and about like the discomfort and like, you know, that sort of tension in American life of like people not liking me for being Jewish. I'm much more worried about the anti-Zionism part.
And in
of
a way,
the
he
sh-
and in a way, he has every right to be worried, and it's understandable that he would be worried, because Americans are turning against Israel in a way that we haven't seen, certainly not. Perhaps ever, certainly not in my lifetime, where, you know, just in March, and there was a Gallup poll that came out that for the first time since October 7th, a majority of Americans disapprove of Israel's war, or was it, you know, or Biden's handling of it, or both. And among Democrats, the number is, I think, close to 75%. And a majority of Democrats oppose. Now a large majority of Democrats oppose sending weapons and military supplies to Israel. I mean, the list goes on with a lot of these polls. It's definitely pronounced among Democrats and the left. And so the Democratic Party, which is obviously, you know, one of the two major parties in the country, is turning very squarely against Israel and is moving more towards sympathy towards the Palestinians. So anyone who is staunchly pro-Israel, in scare quotes, should probably be worried. I mean, something is changing in the public discourse about this in a way that I think in some ways is kind of remarkable. When you have someone as traditionally pro-Israel as Senator Chris Coons or Nancy Pelosi, these are pro-Israel stalwarts who are openly discussing making aid to Israel conditional or talking about halting arms transfers to Israel. Something is changing, but but there's a reason. It's because Israel's conduct has been atrocious in this war. So I think what's sort of weird about this whole campus debate is that we're focusing so much on anti-Semitism. I mean, the primary motivation of students seems to be very clear. They are appalled by Israel's war in Gaza. They are appalled by the death toll, the Palestinian death toll, and just the mass destruction of Gaza and everything that comes with that. So in some ways, we're missing, I think, the fundamental point here. There's a reason that this has aroused so much anger, frustration among students, because they rightly, I think, feel passionately about this topic. They feel passionately about America's complicity in the war, and they want to speak out about that. And they also have demands where they want their universities to divest from companies that are linked to Israel's war effort. So I think we should just, it's worth like not forgetting about like that very basic aspect of this. This is not coming out of nowhere. This is not just a bunch of random students who are being silly and ridiculous and finding some like random cause to latch onto. They are, you know, some of them may be doing that, but at the end of the day, there's legitimate reason to be outraged. And some of these, if not most of these, actually, I would say, presumably most of the students who are protesting are animated by that.
Right. Look, I mean, I think that it's like beyond doubt that you're seeing a generational shift, and that is going to tear Democrats apart in the near term. I mean, I guess the question I'd have for you, you know, I mean, I saw you cite that poll in your recent Washington Post column. I'm not following the polls closely, and I'm not like at all ready to contest that. But let me throw one thing out for you, which I think also informs the anger among the younger generation. You know, you cite Coons and Pelosi. Indeed, Chuck Schumer gave a speech recently as well. Sort of tightening the reins on Israel and on Bibi Netanyahu and the rest of it. I'm struck by the fact how much the old guard of the Democrats are doing a lot of rhetorical pirouetting on this, but actually delivering nothing. The Rafah offensive is likely to happen in the next few days from the news that we're reading, after Biden made a bunch of noise that like must not this, that, the other thing, was like sort of trotting around. My theory of the case is that whatever polling machine is operating at the like heart of, you know, Democratic Central, they're not seeing like the kind of shifts that you're pointing to across America electorally being threatening yet. And so therefore, they're still playing a sort of cosmetic game on aid to Israel in order to placate the activist class and the youth. The Arab American, you know, minority, but are calculating that the downside to them is still much greater to actually change course on Israel policy. And again, I'm going to like empirically claim that once Rafah happens, it'll be with some U.S. Biden administration blessing. It's going to be bloody. There's going to be more death, and it'll happen in the course of all of this. And I would say that part of the anger among students is that they recognize this. They see clearly that part of it, right? That,
yeah.
That like actually you know, Coons and Pelosi and Schumer are full of shit. They are actually blowing smoke in order to distract and like signal, yes, we hear you, but actually nothing's changing. Thoughts?
Yeah,
on
I think you're right about that. And that's kind of what I get at in my Washington Post column, where I talk about the Israel aid bill that now everyone's forgotten about because the campus stuff has taken over. But only 37 out of 213 Democrats in the House voted against Israel aid. That is, I think, like 17%. That is surprising. And there is a major, major disconnect between what the polls say about ordinary Democrats and where actual Democratic politicians are. And I think this is, it's, I can't think of another issue where the disconnect is as large currently. And yeah, people realize that. And I think that the leadership of the Democratic Party is banking that people will move on or forget about it. Or if they're so worked up about how evil Trump is, they'll forget about all the other stuff. And it won't be about Biden. It'll just be about fear of another Trump term. These are big bets. Those are big presumptions. And especially if this keeps on dragging out, and especially if you see a return of kids to campus in September and October, right before the election, and you have another round of this, and God knows what's going to be happening in Gaza in September and October. I mean, we assume that it'll be quiet then. Will it be?
I don't assume that.
Exactly. But I think there's a lot. I think there's a lot of people who are like the Democratic strategists who are like, okay, let's get this war out of the way. Let's push on Israel to end it ASAP and get done what they need to get done. That way we won't have to worry about it for November. I think that's a big assumption.
You know, by the way, I just want to say that was their assumption on Ukraine too. Like, I think it's pretty clear that they wanted that shit done by like now.
What do you mean when you say want that shit done?
They wanted the counteroffensive to like have achieved marginal but not decisive goals, and they wanted both sides at the negotiation table rather than fighting a war.
Yeah, so much for that. And I just think there's Democrats are playing with fire right now. And I've said this time and time again. I think it's a major miscalculation. I think the polling increasingly shows that. Now, do the Democrats who say they disapprove of Israel's war, do they feel about it strongly enough for it to shift their vote? The vast majority, probably not. But in a close election, you don't really need a whole lot of people to shift. So I think that all of this is going to be cutting it very close. I don't think it's really about... I think that what it comes down to is that Biden himself and his national security team, for them, it's partly ideological. Biden has an ideological commitment to Israel that makes him really stubborn on this. And I don't think it's just about, are they doing a kind of careful cause-benefit analysis? That's maybe how they want, like how some people are presenting it. But ultimately, ideas matter, ideology matters, which goes back to our ongoing debate. People aren't just automatons who calculate their rational self-interest. They are affected by history, their own perception of history. Biden is stuck in a time when he remembers Israel being the underdog, and God knows how, like whenever that was in the 1960s. And he still has this image of Israel that is completely outdated. You know, how do you get someone to shift when it's so entrenched in how they view the world? Ideas matter.
Yeah. I mean, I just suggest that, you know, I mean, I guess it was pretty apparent from day one just how nasty this would be when Israel declared that victory would be measured by the utter extirpation of Hamas, which was just an unrealistic goal. I think in a sense, you know, rather than I think your take, I'm less convinced by the take. I mean, I agree that Biden's stubborn and I think your characterization is correct. I think that there is a bigger thing, and it's not just a stubborn old man driving this. It's that a close ally has set itself into like at a task that it is overwhelmingly likely to fail at, and as a result, you know, you're going to have an ally fail by its own terms. And that's a tough thing to swallow, I think, like strategically and the rest of that. So I think that's part of what's also pushing, you know, this like back and forth of like, do it, but like, you know, don't do it so nasty and like win, figure out a way to win. Don't kill so many people, but you have to win. And like at the bottom line is Israel has to win somehow, has to pull out like a credible sense of victory and like wave it around. So, you know, what's his name? The head of Hamas, the battlefield guy in Gaza.
Yeah, he's Sinwar.
Sinwar. Yeah. If Sinwar comes out on day one after the, you know, full-time ceasefire, starts waving a flag and says victory is ours, that's a problem. And it's freaking terrible that, like, you know, those are the stakes that Israel has set for itself now, that like it's overwhelmingly likely that something like that's going to happen.
Yeah, so it's kind of crazy that, as in, I know that you've sort of like, I don't know if joked is the right word, but kind of, you know, the kind of observation that Hamas might actually be able to decisively shift, you know, an American election and tip the balance towards one candidate or the other. I mean, that's kind of incredible when you think about it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And this is also what obviously extremists and terrorist groups can do. They try to do surprising, shocking things that affect the domestic politics of other countries, whether it's Israel or the US. And we fall into that trap and so forth. But it is going to be pretty remarkable. Like, I do wonder if we play out the scenario, if Biden loses and he loses in key states where progressives, you know, were found to stay home, or Arab and Muslim Americans, like we're able to help organize a kind of, you know, a no Biden vote or abstention or staying at home and all that. And then we assess that after the fact and see that that played a role. You know, that's going to be a fascinating kind of postmortem and how people are going to react to it. I mean, obviously, one can imagine a lot of anger towards young progressives and Arabs and Muslims saying, oh, you know, hey, you Arabs, you ruined it for us. I mean, that'll be interesting just to see the internal reckoning that would happen in the party. Yeah. And then, of course, the progressives and Arabs will say, well, Biden ruined it for us. He didn't listen to us. And obviously, both sides here will have legitimate claims, I suppose.
That's Democratic politics. That's how you negotiate, ultimately. And it's with threats like that, basically. I will not vote
and
for
then
you.
The threat ultimately has to be credible.
Right.
I mean, at some point, if the Biden folks... If it's sort of like wink, wink, we Arabs and Muslims will fall back into line once we get closer to the election. Don't worry. We're just trying to get you to do the right thing. Obviously, that's not going to be taken seriously.
It's a game of chicken. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's a dangerous one for, I suppose, the country. But we are where we are. I think another thing to keep in mind is that it's really hard for a party to change an entrenched status quo. If the Democratic Party has been seen as a staunch or somewhat staunch backer of Israel over decades, it really would be an unprecedented shift to see a party that actually listened to its base on this, that actually became a party that was or was perceived to be the pro-Palestine party. That would be a major shift. I don't think we should kind of make light of what a sea change that would be. And obviously, you know, older Democratic Party leaders would not like that and work against that. Obviously, you know, you have, you know, donors to the party who wouldn't be thrilled about that. It would affect the party structurally in interesting ways. And that's not an easy transition. And that transition is going to be, I think, a rough one for the Democratic Party. And what we're seeing, and I think what people are really afraid of with these campus protests, I think they're afraid that these campus protests are a sign of things to come, that a new generation of left of center Americans, that this generation, once it has more influence and more power in our politics, is going to decisively shift not just the Democratic Party's politics, but American politics. That's why we're so concerned about elites. Yeah. Because what elites feel on campus usually doesn't stay on campus. It finds a way to filter out into the broader discourse. That's what we learned with wokeness.
But we also learned, you know, like that the Vietnam generation ended up being a bunch of establishment tools and didn't make America better. There's that element of it. I think the anxiety you're attributing there is to people for whom Israel is a number one issue. That's the anxiety, and I think that's motivating a lot of the sort of talk about, you know, the anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, all the rest of that. That's what's making people nervous. I wonder if what's making Democrats nervous is that is sort of what I was getting at, that like there's passions of youth. There's certainly America is becoming more diverse. I mean, I've remarked on this a while ago. I mean, I was talking to our friend Rachel about this also. I'll just tell the anecdote now, because I may have even said it on a podcast before. I was in somewhere in the Baltics, I think Lithuania, and I was sitting next to the U.S. ambassador to Lithuania several years ago, and she was telling me how, you know, she grew up like as a young woman, she went to Paris with her family, and like Europe and transatlanticism was a big deal. And she mentored young women at the State Department, the rising generation. And she said, you know, the truth is like transatlanticism is not going to be nearly as powerful a force in America going forward, because the majority of people coming up have like no roots in Europe. They have no like special attachment to it. They don't like, their parents didn't take them to Europe, and they don't have any of that sort of stuff. Europe is just another part of the world, you know? So I think it's true. Like, that's changing. Our elite universities are, you know, for all sorts of reasons, even more diverse places, not just because they're being engineered that way. It's because immigrants are more ambitious, and, you know, they strive harder, and like, you know, it's feeding that. So our elites are changing, certainly. But I do wonder whether Democratic strategists still look at this and say the Democrats are going to be eating the short end of the stick, because it's a large enough number of people who are going to be anti-Israel to hurt us, like in turnout for what it is. But we still stand to lose more of like the mainstream American voter, and we're just going to be hobbled by this and not actually have a decisive majority where the country as a whole shifts in the ways that you're sort of hoping for and like dreaming of here, Shadi. You know what I mean? Like that, like, it's a lot of this stuff, kind of like the point being that the Vietnam generation didn't change the country really. That like this generation also won't change the country really. The country is changing, but like not enough for like to have like truly decisive sort of things.
Oh yeah. I don't think that it'll be truly decisive. I mean, one can fantasize about what an actual, I mean, even I've never suggested that the U.S. should kind of divest itself of Israel as an ally and say, hey, you guys are on your own, you know, fuck you. I know, obviously, there are many pro-Palestine activists who want that and think somehow that it could be possible. I don't think that's realistic. But I also just don't think that that's really appropriate or even like right in a sense. Well, first of all, if a country's been an ally for a long time, you don't just say, hey, we're done. I think the better way to approach it is that you use your leverage to put pressure on the ally to behave better. And there is obviously historical friendship. There is a natural affinity between the U.S. and Israel, and we've had that conversation with Walter Russell Mead. His book,
yeah,
I think does a very good job of, what was it called? Just so the
Ark of a Covenant.
The Ark of the Covenant, exactly. Yeah. There is a history here. There is a friendship between nations. There is a kind of like ideological overlap. I don't think that ideological overlap is strong anymore. But when Israel was actually a liberal democracy, like a proper liberal democracy, and not the one that it is now, which is a kind of far right leaning ethno-nationalist state. Although, to be fair, I mean, Israel has always been an ethno-nationalist state, but, you know, I mean, that aside for a moment.
But, you know, I mean, like look, that's the other part that I, you know, I've seen you make that point, and I think that's just like a weird Americanism, quite frankly, is that it's there's a certain antipathy to the very idea that you can have a nation state, and a nation state meaning a state that is like, you know, like ethnically based, which is actually the reality for most, you know, certainly most Western Hemisphere nation states. Okay, maybe not in the in Latin South America, but certainly in Europe, right? Like,
yeah, but they're not explicit about it. But here's the thing: like, I don't think that. Yes, it's implicit, and that is effectively what many of these countries are, ethnostates.
Yeah.
But at least there is, at least there is a pretense.
Yeah.
So, you know, most German politicians are not going to be like, hey, we're a state for Germans. We're the German homeland. obviously.
Give it 10 years, I'm telling you. But anyway.
I mean, obviously, that is where these countries seem to be going, and that's where the mainstream and the center-right seems to be shifting. But there is a pretense to universalism. There's a pretense to equal citizenship for all, regardless of one's origins, right? Is that fair to say? But I take your point.
I think even that is somewhat overstated. I'll say that. I think there's like a big tension in that. And I mean, the tension is manifested in the European Union itself. That's it for part one, dear listeners. There's a lot more where that came from. If you're not yet a paying subscriber, please head on over to wisdomofcrowds.live and become one. Help support our work. Hope to see you in the bonus.